For more presentations like this, visit www.xenos.org.
All right, let's talk about the phenomenon. Let's dive in. So we see that it's somewhat common for skeptics to complain about two things, and I want to complain that these two things are not things that you can have at once. So, for example, they complain about the problem of evil, which is that the world is filled with ugliness. You know, there's pain, suffering, cancer, tsunamis, these kinds of things. And they say, you know, how could the world be like this if God is all-knowing and all-powerful and also all-loving? How could these things be together? Furthermore, they then go on to complain, usually some of the same authors, sometimes even in the same writings, to resent the biblical teaching on judgment. Right? And you might think to yourself, well, yeah, both of those are really bad things, it seems. Seems like the world is awful, and wow, you're just adding, you know, insult to injury by additionally it's bringing judgment, hell, and things like that into the picture. So that it doesn't seem obviously inconsistent, even seems reasonable. But yeah, I plan to argue here that skeptics can't have their cake and eat it too. So let's look at some examples. I've got three different examples of authors whom I will lay out how they show up on A and B here, and then we'll kind of try to diagnose what we're seeing there. So first of all, we're going to talk about David Lewis, who's a philosopher, ranked, to give you an idea of at least his influence in a poll of professional philosophers. He was ranked as second most influential philosopher in the 20th century. The only person who beat him was a guy named Wittgenstein, who maybe you've heard of. If you haven't, and you know, maybe you've never heard of either of these guys, which is very probable. But in any case, David Lewis has a significant amount of influence, whether you've heard of him or not. Edwin Curly is also a philosopher, but specifically one of the things he's best known for is being a Spinoza scholar, who's a guy from the 17th century, a particularly interesting character. And Bart Ehrman, he's probably the one you have heard of, for at least the reason that he has 6 New York Times bestsellers, but he also likes to show up on things like the Colbert Report and, you know, various shows like that. So here, these are our three guys we're going to go through, and let's start with Lewis. So Lewis says in a paper, he says, standard versions of the problem of evil concern the evils that God fails to prevent. Right? So this is kind of what I'm saying. If God is all-knowing, all-powerful, and of course all-loving, why isn't he intervening? Right? In my view, even the most ambitious standard version of the problem of evil succeeds conclusively. So what that means is he actually thinks that evil, along with the fact that God is all-knowing, all-powerful, and all-loving, is actually inconsistent. So that's a particularly strong form of the problem of evil. And he, in spite of the fact that many other people have moved away from this specific version of the problem of evil, he thinks that even that one succeeds. He goes on to say in another section, so here's his word on the problem of evil, and then let's hear what he has to say about judgment. He says, but we might start instead, so going, you know, continuing from this thought, he's like, you know what, but actually this specific paper is called Divine Evil. He's just like, actually, you know, we're not even going to worry about the problem of evil. We're going to talk instead about things that God does that are evil. And at least that's how he presents it. He says, let's start instead from the evils God himself perpetrates. For God, if we are to believe an orthodox story, has prescribed eternal torment as a punishment for insubordination. So I think the usual philosophical discussion of the problem of evil are a sideshow. Right, all the worries about tsunamis and this sort of thing, that's just a sideshow compared to the problem of hell. And then he continues, he says, we seem, namely referring to atheists and skeptics like him, we seem to strain the gnat being the problem of evil, and swallow the camel being hell. Okay, so he seems like, he's like, look, I think the problem of evil works, and in fact, judgment is worse still. Curly, he says, it is commonly said that God must possess all perfections. Okay, there's our all-loving, all-powerful, all that stuff. Yet we observe that the world, this perfect being has created includes many imperfections. There is much joy in the world, but there is also much suffering, much of it apparently undeserved. Elsewhere, he says, the Christian doctrine of the afterlife presents a problem for our assessment of God's moral nature. How can it be just? How could he do this to condemn anyone on whatever grounds to eternal punishment? Okay. So he seems to think that there's never a person who should suffer that way. And this is, maybe surprising. Some of us are like, well, at least the Hitlers of the world and the Stalins, our favorite villains of history, Judas, maybe they should at least go to hell. But he's saying nobody deserves that fate, much less the number of people that the biblical story seems to purport to end up there. What about Bart Ehrman? Okay, so Ehrman actually talks a lot, he's a lot more vivid. And so it's actually perhaps not entirely accidental that he also sells a lot of books. He's quite skillful rhetorically, and for that we can't fault him. But we'll fault him for many other things. But he's being a bad writer as such is not one of them. He says, "Why are the sick still racked with unspeakable pain? Why are babies still born with birth defects? Why are young children kidnapped, raped, and murdered? Why are droughts that leave millions starving, suffering horrible and excruciating lives that lead to horrible and excruciating deaths? If God intervened to deliver the armies of Israel from its enemies, why doesn't he intervene now when the armies of sadistic tyrants savagely attack and destroy entire villages, towns, and even countries? If God is at work in the darkness, feeding the hungry with the miraculous multiplication of loaves, why is it that one child, a mere child, dies every 5 seconds of hunger? Every 5 seconds. So he really wants you to feel the problem here. And it is indeed a problem. I don't want to downplay that. But he really draws it straight to the front. Now, on the judgment question, we actually have a couple of decent quotes from him. He says, referring to his own loss of faith, "I came to believe that there is not a God who is intent on roasting innocent children and others in hell because they didn't happen to accept a certain religious creed." Okay, so you can see why his books sell. They're at least angering to the faithful and exciting to the skeptics. It's like, oh yeah, it's a good way of putting it. It's a good zinger. Here he actually specifically talks about like an episode like Jericho or, some of the things that happened during the Canaanite destruction. So he says, anyone interested in the problem of suffering might wonder, of course, about the inhabitants of Jericho. For the God of Israel, these were foreigners who worshipped foreign gods and so were fit for nothing but destruction. But one might want to think about the innocents who are murdered. Is this really what God is like, one who orders the slaughter of those who are outside of his people? It is not as if the people of Jericho were given the chance to think things over or to turn to him. They were all slaughtered, even the infants, in a divinely appointed bloodbath. All right, so he really likes to sharpen the point and, stick it in a few times and then, maybe even twist it a little. So he's making it as clear as possible that he's disgusted by this phenomenon described in the Bible. Okay. All right. Let's back up and have an initial diagnosis. So we see at least each of these authors says similar things. Why is the world bad? And it seems even worse that God is prepared to judge on a biblical view. These seem ugly. It does seem to me, in a very simplistic sense, And this is sort of where we'll take this. In a simplistic sense, one may not grumble against God's intervention while simultaneously demanding that he intervene. So, you know, we're putting this in the most simple of terms at this point, and of course the atheist will have a comeback to this. But the thought is, look, in essence, when somebody is bothered by the problem of evil, they're saying, God, do something. This is so bad. Right? How could it be that these children starve? How could it be that somebody gets swept up in a massive wave? How could it be that someone just disintegrates under the power of cancer? How could that be? Do something. And yet, at the same time, when God does do something, they're like, no, 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 no. Not like that. That's not what I meant. You have to do it this other way. Okay? So, to be fair, we want to open up some options for the skeptic and to consider them. So, first of all, intervention need not require judgment, right? At least in principle, right? It seems as though, and I'm not saying that this is what I believe, but one might respond, hey, look, I mean, couldn't you just like, I mean, you made the loaves for the people thereafter, you know, when you're feeding the 5,000, why can't you just start multiplying loaves in sub-Saharan Africa where there's a bunch of people dying? Why can't, you know, whenever there's a famine, or, you know, Syria has, you know, a famous famine right now, you know, where are the loaves and the fishes there? Right? Can't you just jump in, perform a miracle? Can't you just stop things from happening? And okay, maybe I'll grant you judgment. Right? If you want to interfere, that's cool. You can even interfere through some sort of judicial action. You know, destroying some bad guys, whoever they may be in whatever circumstances we're considering. But eternal judgment, that's overkill. That's just too much. Why is it that you have to go so far as for it to be eternal? That's too much. Put them in some kind of dark spiritual prison for a time. Sure, serve their sentence. But not forever. Okay, so we'll go through some of these later, and I'm not going to exactly directly engage them, but I'm going to try to perform, like give a diagnosis, a larger diagnosis of how these authors are thinking and how it leads them to this and why I think they're wrong. And that at least from the biblical point of view can tell a coherent story about why God would permit evil, why God would judge as much as I can. I mean, this is not a, you know, this is only an hour long, people. But you know, a basic idea, and then along those lines, and then also kind of show the tension that exists here. But really the core problem is here is it's inappropriate to say, where are you? And then when he shows up and brings judgment, to be upset about that. Okay, let's talk about A. I want to diagnose what's happening with the problem of evil and try to think about what might lead these men to think this way and anyone else that's like them. You know, these aren't the only people that think that, and certainly even some of us who are faithful find these thoughts tempting at times. We find it confusing. First of all, I believe a big problem is that all three of these authors and many people have a very low view of freedom. And I want to articulate that in three separate ways, how that comes about. First of all, some of them just say, who cares? Freedom is not good enough. So Lewis explicitly says, I question the supreme value of incompatibilist freedom. Okay, and that's a fancy way of saying, you know, that's a philosopher's freedom. But essentially, he's saying, I question freedom. If you want to ask me what incompatibilist means later, be my guest. But let's move on. Curley says almost exact same thing. He says, the value that God places on human freedom may seem, on reflection, too high. Okay, so there's just an initial thought that it's just like it's not worth it. Freedom's just not worth it. The other part is there's a question about the scope of freedom. There seems to be a devaluation of how far freedom can actually go. What is the impact of personal decision, and how does that come back on us? So first of all, it seems like each of these authors think like, well, look, God really should be intervening at least to limit the impact of the worst things. So the Holocaust, famine, cancer, right? Let's at least pull that, you know, God, why doesn't he get involved there? Okay. A question that I have in reply to that is, where's the line? Right? Everybody wants God to stop Hitler and Stalin. Right? But if we understand the Bible's teaching on sin, we're not dealing with a difference in kind between us and Hitler, but one of degree. So why is it that we demand that God stop the Holocaust, but almost all of us would be angry if he stopped us from, entering into a foolish marriage? Right? We'd be like, well, hey, now that's my choice to make, right? Because obviously there are things that we do that have huge impact on ourselves and others, our children, say in the case of marriage. Financial choices we make that might be at best foolish, evil, depending on what what you're tempted towards. So I think it's important to remember, at least when it comes to this intervention question, do you want God to intervene in your decisions? All of them? Anytime you're about to do something wrong? Most of us would say, well, no, but I'm not killing, 6 million Jews. And it's like, yeah, but that's the issue, is that this is not a difference in kind, but one of degree. And if God was going to start intervening and restructuring the world in accordance with what he desires, then you better believe we're going to be in his crosshairs as well. Also, I thought about Minority Report, and this is not a perfect example, but some of you guys maybe remember the Tom Cruise movie Minority Report, and the idea is they arrest people before a crime is committed. They use these the so-called precogs, these clairvoyant brothers and sisters or something, who sit in this pool. I don't even know what's going on there, but in any case, somehow they can see the future. And, everything just goes wrong when poor Tom Cruise, one of the future cops, if you could call it that, ends up himself being the object of, coming under investigation, right? Now, most of us feel like there's something significantly morally problematic about there being a police group that does that sort of thing. You arrest someone before they even do it. That seems, there's something wrong now. And, part of what the movie does is it asks a lot of questions about free will and is the future actually fixed and all these kinds of things. But let's just imagine in the case of God, where he actually knows what you'll do, it doesn't seem like the intervention in our moral decisions diminishes in any way. It still seems like we consider, if God sent out his future cops, say he was, he sends angels to go and stop us every time we're about to commit a crime, most of us would consider that very problematic. We're like, this is my choice. Often we feel like we should have the freedom to actually make decisions. And if God is essentially punishing us or judging us for crimes we haven't even committed, there's something troubling about that. Or at least I hope it's troubling. The whole point of that science fiction story is that it should trouble you. I guess maybe you're the kind of person who thinks we should kill baby Hitler. I hope you're not, because that's very troubling. But the idea, that's another way of illustrating this point. Oh, well, we think Hitler's going to go do this thing. Well, we just should kill, if we get the chance, you get a time machine, just kill baby Hitler. You know, it's like that seems extremely morally problematic to judge someone for something before they do it. And that's essentially what's happening with these intervention things. There's a form of judgment where you're intervening and blocking someone's ability from actually fulfilling intentions that they've formed, you know, for good or bad. And so I think it's important to remember that as we're pondering the nature of freedom, and these guys are saying, oh, this just doesn't even matter that much. It's just not even worth it. I think we need to ponder these types of questions. How would it be if God interfered in our choices? And do we really like the idea of a being intervening? That seems morally problematic. Finally, there's the historical fall. Now, these guys are skeptics, all of them. Ehrman's an agnostic. The other two are self-proclaimed atheists. Well, Lewis is dead now. But in any case, it shouldn't be a surprise to us that they don't take Genesis 1 through 3 seriously. So what I'm about to say is not so much that, oh, this is the best reply. What you could say is, here's what I think about these issues. Here's how I think. This is my worldview, and if you'd like to adopt it, you can. I think it explains things really well, but we shouldn't, going into it, assume that they accept it, I guess is what I mean to say. I think that this teaching that comes from Genesis 1 through 3 contains a significant amount of explanatory power when it comes to these issues. First of all, it's really, we need to acknowledge, a lot of times people are like, why is the world like this? God, why did you make it this way? Why are things so bad? Well, according to Genesis 1, he didn't make it this way. It was very good. The way we see things now is how things were created when we took over leadership. When we decided to do our thing. The fall shattered God's creation. Right? And we learn, so not only do we learn that nature itself is corrupted, we read that in Romans 8. We also know that each individual person has also been corrupted by this first decision. Right? That is the teaching of the Bible on sin. So it's important for us to realize that when we look at things like tsunamis or cancer or these types of things where there's not necessarily an immediate cause from another person, it traces back to this first event, this first sin. Also, when humans do things to one another, it also traces back to this first sin, which means this episode in history is really, really important to understand. Especially when we're like, why is the world bad? We should, rather than point the finger, we should, you know, pull the thumb back at ourselves. Okay? So I think that this is important. Now, if you want to put it another way, I said this already. So put this another way. Part of the reason why skeptics are so upset about the way things are, right? So forget about judgment. Forget about the way things could be. You know, what's God going to actually do about all this? At least when it comes to the question of the way things are, it makes sense that they'd be so mad when their starting assumption is that this is the way it should be. That this is how God made things. Now, it's possible that the Christians that they spend time with like to say really like light and airy Pollyanna nonsense. And, you know, I think we should be careful about that because there are many people who are quite troubled by the direction that the world has gone in. And so I think we need to be prepared to discuss that with them. And not just be like, oh, isn't everything just so jolly? Okay, let's talk then about judgment. So there's something there to ponder as it concerns the problem of evil. But now let's move on to the question of judgment. How can we understand where these men are coming from or anyone like them? First of all, I think modern moral standards, modern ethical theories play a significant role in this. First of all, we live in an anti-judgment climate. I literally, my gym that I go to is a judgment-free zone. And, you know, so it's like, and that's cool. You know, like I can go there and, you know, I don't have to be perfect, you know, whatever. So the point is that it's like it's very gauche to be judgmental, right? We need to be tolerant. Okay, so we live in that kind of anti-judgment climate. But I think it goes very deep, you know, that we don't. Our current teaching is that, you know, well, anyhow, I guess the point is that we see this primarily in the developed West. And I think that's important to note. Why do I say that? Right? So this is the nature of our culture. This is what we see. And it's noticeable, too, that when you go to other parts of the world, they see suffering, and they know God's there, and they may even ask questions, but you don't see the same sort of anguish or irritation in other parts of the world. Definitely in the developed West, this is something that we've inherited from the Enlightenment. And so, now, what am I saying? Okay, maybe you're just like, so what? Those guys believe that thing, I believe this thing. Why am I supposed to care? I am not saying, it's important to note, I am not saying just because the majority of people throughout history believed this thing and we believe another thing that therefore they're right and we're wrong. That's a fallacy. It's called the appeal to the people. We're just like, well, you see everyone else thinks this, so you should be thinking that too. What's wrong with you? That's not what I'm saying. But the fact that so many people don't find this as troubling, the fact that so many people throughout history seem to not be as bothered about judgment and God's right to do that and how all these things fit together, at least should make us ask the question about how much our culture is influencing our moral views. Many of us do not think about how much we just take on without even thinking about it from our culture. I heard it said recently, I thought this was a nice quote. I think it was, I read it in a Piercy book. She said, the beliefs that are in your worldview that are the deepest are the ones that you don't even know you believe. And with stuff like this, as far as feeling like, how could God judge? That is one of those ones that's very deep in how we think in this culture. It's funny because when you read like Romans 6, Paul makes an argument based on the fact that he's like, well, if it was like that, then God couldn't judge. He assumes that judgment is good and should happen. And he's assuming that his audience thinks that as well. And yet we're like, oh, judgment. Oh, no, there's no way. Hell, I can't even believe anyone would believe in that. So what I'm saying is we need to ask ourselves, how much does our culture influence our moral beliefs? And I guess essentially I'm saying in these cases, they, of course, have no reason not to believe that because they're part of the culture creators. You know, these guys are big thinkers. But in any case, they seem to have adopted that without further consideration. Shallow biblical reading is another issue here. So a lot of them are like, okay, here's, you know, this is what the Bible says. These are the consequences. So first of all, let's start with the eternal hell problem, right? Curly and all these guys are like, I can't even believe that there'd ever be eternal hell. First of all, and Lewis calls it insubordination. Right, insubordination is like what you do with your boss. Like, you know, it's kind of like lightweight, typically. You know, you're just like, oh, you're just kind of talking back. You know, it has a very mild flavor to it. Sin is not mere insubordination. It's something that is with deep within our identity. Sin and death are something that start necessarily from within and come from a deeper identity. Right? We read this in Romans 5, we read this in 1 Corinthians 15, that through Adam, death came into the world. We have an identity that starts there and that causes sin. These guys are evaluating things in sort of a way where it's like, well, did you do something wrong? There should be a punishment associated with the wrong. And then, you know, you've served your sentence, you may go, whatever. That's not the biblical worldview. The biblical worldview is that sin comes out of sinners, right? That you don't just, we don't make sinners because we sin. We sin because we're sinners, right? And so that more fundamental identity, the Bible teaches, has to be addressed. So it's not just like we're praying for these crimes and yeah. So we have to change our identity in Adam. Otherwise, the sin will just keep going, right? In fact, if you think about it, suppose we did just adopt this simplistic legal perspective. Suppose we imagine, let's just go ahead and just, you know, you get maybe a year for lying to your mom in hell. And, you know, when you cheated on your taxes, you know, that's like a couple months or, you know, whatever. And the problem with that is until your identity's fixed, you're just going to keep committing crimes in prison. I mean, that's actually a thing that happens in actual prison, is people just, you know, continue to do crime. And so the idea is, look, suppose we did just issue a finite sentence for each one of your sins, and then you die, and the thought is, oh, well, you're fine now. You'll just serve out, you know, you only had finitely many sins, and then since you're in that time frame, and so you'll serve those out, and then you can be in heaven, and everything's going to be great. No, the problem is, until your identity is fixed, you're just going to keep sinning in prison. The problem doesn't go away unless the identity is altered. And so the infinite and eternal punishment is a result of the identity. The fact, until you change that, the sin will just keep coming, and more sentences, finite though they may be, will just keep coming. What about the Canaanite conquest? So this one's pretty gnarly. How do we deal with that? All right. Well, first of all, I think it's important to note that there seems to be, and Ehrman talks about this and many other authors comment on this, they hate the Canaanite conquest. And it's weird. It's hard to know what to do with. But again, that's the culture speaking in me. I don't know. A crucial thing is that if you read throughout the Old Testament, this culture was pretty gnarly. We're talking about child sacrifice, bestiality, incest, ritual prostitution. In Leviticus, God is saying, okay, he gives one of the most heinous lists of sexual sins, just one after the other. Not animals, not, and you're just like, oh my God, why is this in the Bible? And he's like, do not be like the nations that were here before you. Because of these things, they were vomited out of the land. And so the point is, we're dealing with some pretty gnarly case. We're not just dealing with some, you know, friendly folks that were farming in the land of Canaan. And along came the Israelites with axes. And, you know, it's like we're dealing with people who are doing some pretty gross stuff. And if you go all the way back to Genesis 15, God says to Abraham, the sin of the Amorites has not reached completion. He doesn't judge them back in Genesis 15. He has to wait, apparently. Which kind of comes back to our minority report point. So we see that there seems to be a lack of awareness of what was actually going on during the conquest. This is crucial. Race always comes up. They're like, this is absolutely genocide. It's the worst thing ever. The two most central, the very earliest stories during the conquest completely obliterate the fact that this is about race. The first example is you look at Rahab. Rahab was a woman in Jericho. She was a Canaanite. She was saved. Slightly later, Achan, the Israelite, stole from Jericho, and he was judged. The issue is obedience to God, not what race you are. Rahab, obedient. Achan, disobedient. Race is irrelevant. And it's hard to mistake the fact that God made sure to include that in there. If the Bible didn't make it clear enough that race was an issue, we read in Deuteronomy, he's like, it's not because you guys are special. He says it three separate times in Deuteronomy 9. He's like, I'm not letting you have this land because you guys are great. You're horrible. You're a stiff-necked people. He says that three times in succession. He doesn't like say it a little bit here and then later in the chapter. He says three times in succession, do not think I gave you this land because you are good. You're a stiff-necked people. And so this idea that, oh, it's because you guys are perfect or something like that is mistaken. Okay, on babies. I got to tread really lightly here. Help me out if you can during discussion. I feel like I have to do this because it comes up. So again, I'm treading lightly as possible, but please help during Q&A. It's hard. Before I go any further, my wife just gave birth to a son in December, okay? So it's not like I'm just some cold, heartless, you know, like you don't even understand, you know? First of all, this is essential. I think this is the most, probably without this, the whole thing would be very puzzling. The Bible does give evidence that children do not face judgment. It's tucked away in little places throughout. For example, in Numbers 14, the fact that the young, when the older Israelites were judged for not entering into the promised land, the children get to go in. If they're under 20, they were cool. So somehow there was a generational distinction made. The second one, there's a lot here. I'm going to cover this one real quick. This one's very strange. In 1 Kings 14, God says to a woman who comes to visit a prophet concerning her son. And she says, look, you know, he's sick. What do I do? And he's like, okay, you know what? Actually, I'm about to completely obliterate the house of Ahab. It's going to be really ugly. But this child is the only one in whom I have found anything good. So he gets sick and dies. That must mean that somehow death is not the worst thing that could happen. So somehow God uses the opportunity of, you know, basically this kid getting sick and dying before this goes down is actually an act of mercy. So look, these are tough cases. Don't get me wrong. But we're seeing something here about that God has a kind of merciful heart towards the young. You sometimes hear this talk of, and these are the passages that bring forward this theological teaching of the age of accountability. There is a certain point where we are accountable to our choices, and there's a certain point before that where we are not accountable. Children are not mentally developed enough to be held accountable unto judgment, it seems like. And this, again, you can go read those passages in your own time and ponder them yourselves, but that's where that teaching comes from. Now, if that's true, then it means that these young children are instantly placed in God's care at death and presumably are better off than if they were stuck with their evil parents who were willing to sacrifice them. Hard case to make, and it's obviously not the norm. God clearly doesn't operate this under normal circumstances. But the point is, if you have these parents who are just going to do, you know, whether that's incest, whether that's child sacrifice, wouldn't it be a little bit better? It seems like actually this is merciful. And there's another practical issue here that I think people never think about. What if the parents must be judged? Right? Would it be better for the children to be left exposed, roaming the streets of a destroyed town with no parents? And should the Israelites adopt them? What's the best case scenario, all things considered? These are really hard questions. Now, in light of the current political situation as it concerns separating children from their parents, I want to have nothing to do with that debate whatsoever. Very, very difficult. But this is hard. This is hard. Here's a key thing that I think you should ponder whenever you read passages like this of children dying in Bible. Do not give up what you know for something you don't know. That's an important proverb when we're considering these hard cases. Now, I'm giving some very, perhaps even clumsy attempts to make sense out of this from what we do have in Scripture. But after a certain point, we're being speculative. And so what I want to say is, what's taught over and over and over again in the Bible is that God is loving and that God is just. And so when it comes to particular cases where we don't really know what's going on, it's better to say, I don't know. If we just, at a certain point, we have to step back and be like, I guess I don't know. So don't let those types of cases throw you off when the other stuff is clear enough. Let's go to the root. Behind all these gripes is the following sentiment. And I kind of said this earlier, but I think this sentiment, when it concerns judgment and as it concerns the problem of evil, this is behind it. If I were God, and if I created things, and if my moral standards were going to be used, this is how I would do things, even if it's inconsistent or inharmonious. You, God, have been doing it all wrong. You know, you're not allowed, you know, oh, I see that. Why didn't you get involved? Why didn't you do something? You could have done something you didn't. Why? And what about the, and why are you judging people? How dare you? Now, there's some level where this sentiment is frankly outrageous, right? It is kind of just foolish, okay? And what do I mean by that? It's foolish because we're so limited. We know a very, very small amount of information about the world, especially as individuals. And many of us, though, feel very comfortable saying how messed up it is that God does this or does that. But there's a doubly tragic irony in this sentiment. And it's this. First of all, this is the very sentiment that got us into this in the first place. No, God, what you want and what you've set out for me in this garden, that's not, I don't want that. I actually think when I look at this apple, when I look at the fruit of the knowledge, from the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, it does look tasty. And apparently it brings wisdom, so says the serpent. I think I'm going to do my way and I'm not going to listen to you. That's really at the essence of this and is, you know, the root of the sin reflex. And in particular, it is that very spirit of defiance, which is to actually blame for the things that lead to the problems in this world, and also the things that causes God to judge us. Why do I say that? Think about it like this. If we never sinned in the garden, there would be no problem of evil, there would be no judgment. And so for us to say, you're not allowed to judge, don't do it that way, do it this way, the way I want, and I can't believe you haven't intervened, you haven't done anything about all this, is basically brings us straight back to the original problem, which is that I should be God not God. Now, I want to ponder this for a moment practically, and this is slightly on the theological side of things up to now. So here's a final practical remark that I want us to ponder before discussion. So Schaeffer, in his famous book, The God Who Is There, after which this conference is named, describes a number of artists and writers and the kinds of things that, you know, maybe he's expecting Christians to be like, that's crazy. So he says, these paintings, these poems, and these demonstrations, and maybe you could substitute here philosophical views for what we just covered, which we've been talking about, are the expression of men who are struggling with their appalling lostness. Dare we laugh at such things? Dare we feel superior when we view their tortured expressions in their art? You know, so for us, we've been given the word. We didn't come up with the word. God decided to tell us these things, to teach us about ourselves. So it's tempting when we hear all this stuff to be like, Lewis, Ehrman, jerks. The idea is we should stop laughing and take these men seriously. Then we shall have the right to speak again to our generation. These men are dying while they live, yet where is our compassion for them? There is nothing more ugly than a Christian orthodoxy without understanding or without compassion. And so when we ponder these tough issues, aside from trying to have an answer to them, because they are puzzling in some ways at least, we should have a heart of compassion for these people that believe them. Whether they're as articulate as folks like the philosophers, I'm sure you're encountering people that literally believe those exact two things. I can't understand why the world is so bad, and I definitely can't understand why there'd be judgment. And so I think we need to approach those people with compassion and try to teach them God's ways and help them to see maybe some of these things that are underneath them, help correct some of the confusions about the Bible and about what it teaches.
This study was recorded at Xenos Christian Fellowship and is copyrighted. You may freely copy and distribute it as long as you keep it intact and do not sell it.